The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're going to start off today with Oprah Daily Insider section. And Oprah says, I want to send a special shout out to BIL.2719, Jenna John, TSN112, and Neera, and everyone who watched my ABC special, Shame, Blame, and the Weight Loss Revolution, last week and responded or were enlightened by the conversation. To all of you, I say thank you. Vicky spoke for many, I think, when she posted, I think the best thing that came out of the show is for those who have suffered with obesity their whole life, it is now understood that it is a disease, not about willpower or being lazy or judged for being overweight. There is an answer. But, sadly, the average human being cannot afford the treatment. You're right, Vicky. That's the next conversation I want to take on. Cost, access, and people having to jump through hoops to get these medications. In the meantime, my great hope is that understanding that obesity is a disease helps liberate a world of people who've struggled and blamed themselves for years. That was the big intention. And hearing from you all has been the great reward that my intention was fulfilled. Many more conversations to come. Have a great week. Our next article is the Word of the Week, Toxic Positivity. Why telling someone to just be happy can have the opposite effect. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Smile, you'll get over it, is not a good response to someone going through a hard time. In fact, it can make that person feel way worse. It's offering someone a very simple solution for a complicated problem you know nothing about, explains Whitney Goodman, a psychotherapist in Miami and author of Toxic Positivity. It typically includes using encouraging statements to minimize or eliminate painful emotions, or to pressure someone to be unrealistically optimistic without considering the circumstances. We're not saying positivity is a bad thing. Toxic positivity just takes it a step too far, like telling someone you have so much else to be grateful for when they lose their job. Goodman says that it often shames the recipient into feeling like their emotions aren't valid, as if it's not okay to be sad or angry. This approach can be well-intentioned, simply wanting to make someone feel better, but usually comes across as dismissive. We often use it to end a conversation or avoid taking responsibility, Goodman says. As always, listen emphatically. It's better to tell someone, gosh, that really sucks, than, you'll be fine, I just know it. This is from Relationships. A Gen Xer and a millennial walk into a bar. The data has caught up with three sets of intergenerational besties already know big age gaps between friends bring big mental health benefits. This article is by Vivian Manning-Schaffel, S-C-H-A-F-F-E-L. Generational identification is such a thing these days, with endless memes floating about pitting Gen Xers, born 1965 to 1980, against millennials, born 1981 to 1996. As a Gen Xer, I work with brilliant millennials all the time, but must admit some quirks I'd witnessed seem to align with those memes. 8 years ago, these preconceptions evaporated when I met Julie, a next-door neighbor, 19 years my junior, when our dogs sniffed hello on the sidewalk. We began texting each other to time our dog walks, and it wasn't long before our easy affinity made me realize our compatible personalities, shared interests, and aligned values were more fertile ground for a close friendship than whether or not we'd graduated high school or college during the same recession, had kids, or were staring down the same milestones. We share a laugh and hold space for each other in a way that makes us both feel seen and, most importantly, understood. Intergenerational friendships are scientifically proven to be advantageous for both parties, offering benefits such as increased empathy and improved cognitive function. Monica O'Neill, a Boston-based clinical psychologist and relationship expert, who happens to be an Xennial born on the cusp between Gen X and Millennial, says both Gen Xers and Millennials can offer each other clarity and a deeper sense of perspective about life. Most people will say they see things differently when they hear them from their friend's viewpoint, she says. Having younger friends can open up your perspective and help you see things through multiple lenses. Having a friend who is 15 or 20 years older can hold you accountable and, in loving ways, reflect the best parts of you and help you grow to where you want to be. According to the Survey Center on American Life, the pandemic was brutal on friendships, and young women appear to have been more affected than those in different age groups. Nearly 6 in 10, 59%, report losing touch with at least a few friends, and 16% say they no longer in regular contact with most of them. During these unprecedented times of pervasive loneliness, we need interpersonal 3D connections more than ever, especially among people with different life experiences. To that end, I spoke to three pairs of Gen X and Millennial friends about how they bonded, what they mean to each other, and what they've learned from each other. Jessica Cohen, 54, and Daniela Schiliro, S-C-H-I-L-I-R-O, DePaolis, DePaolis, 30, New York City. Cohen. We're both art directors and met at work, so we both understand the fast-paced environment we work in. Daniela keeps me young. She's very supportive of me, but more than that, she's a cheerleader. When she talks about wanting to have kids, I give her advice, but most of the time, I feel like I'm the one that's younger. I'm not as confident. All the time I ask her, why are you so wise? You're only 30. Millennials don't seem as burdened by fear and worry about what other people think. Daniela always tries to help me not to worry about those things. She's not afraid to stand up for herself, whether it's at work or in relationships. She's fearless in a way I wish a lot of Gen Xers were. Millennials are better with their personal boundaries. They don't suck it up as we do. They have a truer sense of equality in their relationships. Schiliro DePaolis. Jess has so many friends she can relate to anyone. She provides me with a better understanding of the bigger picture. I think it's very easy for millennials to get confused by all the messages they get on social media. Speaking to Jess and getting real-life advice has been so helpful for me in terms of my mental health and bringing me out of the internet world. There are no egos with us. I feel like I learn from Jess every day when it comes to people skills and understanding how people work, even men. She has years of experience that I don't have and that I always wanted to learn from. I'm honored that she comes to me for advice, too. She's always asking, how do you just ask and go for it? I'm very happy to be her cheer squad. She always says she thought she'd be recognized if she kept grinding and working. I'm like, no, you have to ask. Beth Stednicki Verheyen, and that's V-E-R-H-Y-E-N, 50, Hudson, Massachusetts, and Deidre Raboin, R-A-B-O-I-N, 33, Lancaster, Massachusetts. Stednicki Verheyen. We met at the spa we both worked at. She was probably showing me the ropes. Deidre is a year older than my daughter. Being friends with her has helped me to be less judgmental of my adult kids and the decisions they make. I just try to meet everyone where they are. A 50-year-old can be a jerk, and a 30-year-old can be a jerk. I thought millennials could be a little entitled, believing everyone needs to get an A for effort. Everything has to be fair. As Gen Xers, we know that life isn't fair. I also thought millennials were all over social media, but Deidre is not in it all. She'd rather meet face-to-face and do things in person. I find her to be an upfront, honest, humble, great person. I celebrate her every day. We bonded over a shared sense of humor. She's very funny once she lets her guard down and opens up. The way she was parented is much different than the way I parent. She had to be responsible and self-sufficient at the ripe old age of 18. She would be like, "You're the nicest mom ever," because I would bend over backward for my kids all the time. Ray Bowen. When we first met, I had no idea how old she was. I'm terrible at guessing ages. A little further into our friendship, I found out I was going to be at the same college as her daughter. Our values are very similar, and I feel like I can talk about anything with her. Even though our life experiences have been different, we find similarities with each other. I don't feel like she judges me when I talk about different things I've gone through. I thought Gen Xers could be a little on the close-minded side, based on what I'd encountered with people of a similar age. But Beth is just so accepting of everyone and people's differences. When I hang out with her, the age difference isn't even a thought. She might make a comment about her daughter or son, and I'll be like, "Oh, that's right. I'm the same age as your kids." Elena Ewan, 55, Raleigh, North Carolina, and Layla Wanolik, 30, Durham, North Carolina. Ewan, I was chief of staff for the state's first lady, and Layla was the assistant. We never fell into those typical generational tropes. "I'm older, and you should listen to me," and she never judged me, thinking, "Oh my God, you're so old, you don't know anything." There was a case where someone at work was treating me disrespectfully. She went and talked to the first lady, and they acted on it immediately. Meanwhile, I thought I just had to sit there and suck it up. I was the first brown woman in this role, so I really wasn't going to ruffle feathers. Layla was like, "Oh, hell no." Wisdom goes both ways. I've learned a lot about how she views the world from where she sits. Layla is closer to my son's age, so I ask her to listen to what my kid is going through. She's closer to it than I am. She also taught me not to be so judgmental. It's paradoxical because, honestly, both of us are kind of judgy, which is something we bonded over. But she's helped me open my eyes. She taught me how to think about things with more joy. Typically, I would feel the burden of the world, and she's like, "Elena, we're not over here curing cancer. It's okay to have fun at work." Wolinick, our lives are so different, but the big unifying thing is that we can just laugh together and find a lot of the same things really funny. Something we immediately could do is trust each other. You know, you can trust somebody if you can talk with them. Everybody needs a friend like her. Elena is a person of integrity who holds her friendships in high regard. She makes life special for people. I want to emulate that. She showed me so many things I was resistant to learning from my parents, from etiquette to style to how to make your kid's birthday special or people you know feel valued. She taught me how to live with integrity. I didn't realize I could do those things until I saw a model of it in her. Parts of this article were edited due to time. In culture and news, Cameron Diaz and Benji Madden welcomed their second child together. And this article is by Amy Lutkin. On Friday, March 22nd, Cameron Diaz and Benji Madden announced they welcomed their second child, a son named Cardinal Madden. The couple shared a joint statement on Instagram with an illustration, deciding not to share any photos of the infant. "We are blessed and excited to announce the birth of our son, Cardinal Madden," they wrote in the caption. "He is awesome, and we are all so happy he is here. For the kid's safety and privacy, we won't be posting any pictures, but he's a really cute. We are feeling so blessed and grateful, sending much love from our fam to yours. Best wishes, and good afternoon. The illustration is a mix of floral and abstract shapes with a portrait drawing and the words "A little bird whispered to me." Madden and Diaz were married in 2015 and welcomed their daughter Radix in 2019, again noting they would not be sharing photos of their baby. We are so happy, blessed, and grateful to begin this new decade by announcing the birth of our daughter, Radix Madden, they wrote at the time. She has instantly captured our hearts and completed our family. In 2022, an insider told U.S. Weekly that after Radix, Diaz and Madden were considering a bigger family. Cameron and Benji have discussed having another child and have even been looking into surrogate options for a while now, the source said at the time. Benji always wanted a big family, and Cameron didn't need to be persuaded after the arrival of their daughter. The insider added, they would love a boy, of course, but just want a healthy baby. The surrogacy with their daughter was something they had a lot of doubts about going in. Turned out to be the best thing they ever did. Another article in Culture and News. Kate Middleton is being treated for cancer, Kensington Palace announces. The Princess of Wales has released a heartfelt, personal message revealing her diagnosis. This article is by Victoria Murphy. When Kate Middleton underwent abdominal surgery in January, one of the only things Kensington Palace advised about her condition was that it was not thought to be cancerous. However, subsequent tests have revealed that cancer was present, and the princess has chosen to reveal her diagnosis in a heartfelt personal message on March 22nd. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family, she said in the message, after stating that she had been diagnosed with cancer and was being treated with a course of what she described as preventative chemotherapy. The news comes after weeks of intense online speculation about the princess's welfare, following her absence from public duties. However, Kensington Palace said today that the timing of this announcement was connected to when the princess felt it was the right time for her and her family to share this news publicly. It comes as King Charles is also being treated for an undisclosed form of cancer. Like the king, the princess has chosen not to disclose what kind of cancer she has, and other than saying she is receiving preventative chemotherapy, she is not giving any other information about her treatment. The princess is understood to have started her preventative chemotherapy in late February, and it continues. Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis are currently on break from school for the Easter holidays, and announcing this now means that William and Kate will be able to better protect their children from the noise and attention that such an announcement will undoubtedly generate. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment, she said. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that is appropriate for them, and to reassure them that I am going to be okay, Kate said. Kate's video message was recorded by BBC Studios on Wednesday, March 20th. She filmed while sitting on a bench in Windsor. The princess is understood to be feeling in good spirits and focused on her recovery. She fully intends to go about her daily life while undergoing treatment and recovering, and the family is asking for privacy at this time. I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you, personally, for all the wonderful messages of support and for your understanding whilst I have been recovering from surgery. It has been an incredibly tough couple of months for our entire family, but I've had a fantastic medical team who have taken great care of me, for which I am so grateful. In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I am now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that is appropriate for them, and to reassure them that I am going to be okay. As I have said to them, I am well and getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body, and spirits. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance, too, as is the love, support, and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you will understand that, as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I am able, but for now I must focus on making a full recovery. At this time, I'm also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease, in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone. Continuing on in culture and news, Prince Harry and Duchess Meghan's individual bios are removed from the royal family website. The update affects their kids, too. This article is by Rosa Sanchez. Prince Harry and Duchess Meghan have just gotten a downgrade on the British royal family website. Before today, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex had individual bios on the site royal.uk, like the rest of the family members. But now their bios have been joined together under the section for the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Plus, the intro to the section now reads, "As announced in January 2020, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex have stepped back as working members of the royal family. The couple married in St. George's Chapel, Windsor, on 19 May 2018, have two children, Prince Archie of Sussex and Princess Lilibet of Sussex." Prince Archie and Princess Lilibet's bios have also been removed from the family homepage. The royal family website contains over 5,000 pages of information about the life and work of the royal family, a Buckingham Palace spokesperson said in a statement in 2023. Following the death of Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, content has been revisited and updated periodically. Some content may be out of date until this process is complete. Readers know Harry and Meghan stepped back as senior royals in 2020 and have since been living in Montecito, California with their kids. The couple are no longer allowed to use the HRH styling or the word royal in their projects, and so their Sussex royal Instagram has also not been active since March 2020. They have, however, launched many projects of their own, including their charity, Archwell, and a Netflix docuseries on their love story. Harry also released a memoir, Spare, while Meghan had her own podcast, Archetypes, and recently launched a lifestyle platform, American Riviera Orchard, from which she will sell all sorts of goods, including cookbooks, tableware, and natural jams. Again, in culture and news, Whoopi Goldberg's weight loss journey, how Manjaro helped her slim down from nearly 300 pounds. The View co-host said she was inspired after filming her 2020 movie, Till. This article is by Karen, K-A-R-I-N, Miller. Weight loss medications have been a hot topic for months, with Oprah and other public figures opening up about using them to shed pounds. Now, Whoopi Goldberg just revealed that she also used a popular drug to slim down after reaching a weight that concerned her. The 68-year-old shared the news on The View during a discussion about Oprah's new special, Shame, Blame, and the Weight Loss Revolution. "My weight has come and gone and up and down, but it's never been an issue for me because I don't listen to what other people say about me," she said. But after gaining weight during a near-fatal health scare, Whoopi said she used Mounjaro to feel like herself again. Here's what she shared. She weighed nearly 300 pounds during the making of Till. Whoopi realized she had gained weight during the making of Till in 2022. In the film, Whoopi played Mamie Till Bradley, an educator who wanted justice after the murder of her 14-year-old son Emmett in August 1955. She also produced the movie. "I will tell you, I weighed almost 300 pounds when I made Till," she said. She was recovering from a near-fatal health scare. Till was shot not long after Whoopi recovered from a scary health incident. After catching what she thought was the common cold, the host landed in the hospital and was diagnosed with pneumonia in both lungs. The EGOT winner also had sepsis, a life-threatening complication in which the body responds improperly to an infection, per the Mayo Clinic. Instead of fighting the disease, the body turns on itself, causing organs to work poorly. To treat the diagnosis, Whoopi was prescribed steroids and a number of medications, but the drugs had some adverse side effects. "I had taken all those steroids. I was on all this stuff," she shared, noting that she didn't realize that she had gained weight until she looked at herself in the mirror one day. "I just always felt like me, and then I saw me, and I thought, oh, that's a lot of me." She has used diabetes drug Mounjaro to lose weight. Whoopi shared that she used a weight loss medication to shed the pounds. "One of the things that's helped me drop the weight was the Mounjaro. That's what I used," she said. Whoopi's The View co-host Sunny Hostin also shared that she used Mounjaro to lose weight after gaining 40 pounds during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mounjaro is a medication designed to control blood sugar levels in patients with type 2 diabetes. However, the medication has also been used off-label for weight loss. The active ingredient in Mounjaro, tirzepatide, has since been FDA approved for weight loss under the same Zepbound. Mounjaro is similar to fellow diabetes drug Ozempic, which is also used off-label for weight loss. But there are a few key differences. The active ingredient in Ozempic is semaglutide, while the active ingredient in Mounjaro is tirzepatide. Both work to increase insulin production. Research has found that tirzepatide helps patients lose more weight by targeting an additional receptor. Ultimately, Whoopi urged people to be kinder to each other concerning the subjects of weight and weight loss. "Maybe the key is to stop judging everybody. Maybe that's the key," she said. This next article is in the Work and Money section. Getting serious? You need to have this money conversation now. Financial intimacy doesn't sound sexy, but it's vital to a healthy relationship. Seal the deal with these talking points. This article is written by Manisha Thacker. It's time for couples to have the talk. When I say the talk, I mean a conversation about financial intimacy. As a longtime financial educator, I've seen far too many committed couples flounder when they discover that they are utterly and completely financially mismatched. Talking money with your honey early and often is actually one of the most loving things you can do in a relationship. But most people don't know where to even begin. Here are three important money questions every serious couple should have. Number one, I'll show you mine if you show me yours. I can't tell you how many people I know who will go into excruciating detail about their preferences in the bedroom, yet are totally in the dark about the specifics of their loved one's financial situation. I've even seen cases of people marrying without knowing that their beloved's salary, let alone whether they are drowning in credit card debt. When we are considering a long-term commitment, our friends often ask us if we are physically attracted to our partners and if we share compatible family or spiritual values. But one of the top causes of relationship stress has nothing to do with these factors. Money is a silent third party in your relationship, touching almost every part of your daily life. According to a 2023 CNBC study, 74% of working Americans are stressed about money, and 61% are living paycheck to paycheck. As the American Psychological Association highlights in its 2023 Stress in America survey, the emotional and psychological impacts of such stress are wide-ranging and can significantly reduce life satisfaction. To have a lasting love story, it is essential to get financially naked with your partner. At a minimum, I recommend that committed couples share these five numbers. Number 1, expected annual income. Number 2, best guess at monthly expenses. Number 3, current value of all assets such as retirement accounts and other investments. Number 4, amount and type of any debt. Number 5, financial obligations from prior relationships such as alimony or child support. Number 2, who's picking up the check? You know, that awkward feeling at the end of a first or second date when the check comes and you're trying to figure out whether you're splitting it or one of you is treating? Well, that feeling doesn't go away once you're committed. For example, what happens when one person comes into the marriage with a massive student debt? Will the couple pay it off together, or will it remain the responsibility of the person who incurred it? Down the road, there may be issues related to elder care. Do each of you find your own partner's needs, or is this a shared expense? What about philanthropy? Will you give to charity together or agree a set amount that you can each donate to your favorite causes? A great way to preemptively address who is responsible for what in a marriage is to talk about whether you want to merge all, some, or none of your money. Based on this answer, you can work together to create guidelines for how different situations will be treated. For example, if a couple decides they want to merge all their funds, they can set a dollar amount above which they agree to check with each other before spending, and a dollar amount that each is free to spend monthly, no questions asked. No matter which arrangement you select, the idea is to create bumper rails as you travel through life to reduce the odds of having a head-on financial collision. You'll want to revisit this conversation, especially at life's pivotal moments. What if one of you wants to take a few years off from work to raise a family? How will that impact the financial dynamic of your relationship? Or what if one of you gets laid off and it takes a long time to find another job? Significant life changes such as marriage, births, career transitions, retirement, and unexpected opportunities can shake up the snow globe of household finances as decisions are made about everything from where to live to how to spend your time. One way to kick off this portion of the talk is to use tools like the Financial Compatibility Quiz I designed with my Get Financially Naked co-author, Sharon Kedar. That's K-E-D-A-R. It helps couples identify their mutual knowledge, interests, and behaviors so they can better understand where potential conflicts might arise. Life transitions, no matter your means, can fracture romantic bonds if your partner's values and priorities turn out to be very different from yours. By broaching these questions now with respect and empathy, you'll be ready when shifts occur. Number 3, what does enough look like to you? Driven individuals sometimes have real trouble slowing down to enjoy life's small pleasures. Many of us falsely believe that we are what we do, and if we're not working or earning or racking up accomplishments, we feel empty inside. When your self-worth revolves around your net worth, you may never feel whole because that magical number you're aiming for typically moves farther away the closer you get to it. It's important for couples to understand what enough looks like for them. There's no right or wrong answer. Enough might mean that you cover your essential living expenses without taking on debt and have enough left over to go out to dinner a couple times a month. For others, enough looks like affording private school tuition and summers in the countryside. As long as you and your partner are united in your idea of enough and then it leaves room for the two of you to connect and spend time seeking out the things in life that bring you joy, you're on a solid path to a long-term financial union. And by the way, it's okay if you don't have the exact same values and behaviors around money. The point is to talk about areas where there may be friction and come up with a plan together to address these pain points in a way that feels liberating versus constraining to both of you. Here's to your lasting love story, accomplished by being brave and honest when it comes to getting financially intimate. It's the best long-term investment you can make. There's a book that accompanies this article. It's called Money Zen by Manisha Thacker, and it's $27 at Bookshop. And it says, Money Zen, the secret to finding your, and in quotes, enough. Manisha Thacker has worked in financial services for more than 30 years with an emphasis on women's economic empowerment. Thacker earned her MBA from Harvard Business School and a BA from Wellesley College. Her website is moneyzen.com. In the lifestyle section, we have the article, Christina Applegate Health Update. Everything to know about her multiple sclerosis diagnosis. The actress just announced her new podcast with soprano star Jamie Lynn Sigler. This article is by Karen Miller. Christina Applegate has some big news to share. The Dead to Me star is starting a podcast about her experience with multiple sclerosis alongside her friend and soprano star Jamie Lynn Sigler, according to People. The first episode of their new podcast, called Messy, drops on March 19th. The actress, who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2021, told People that she first connected with Jamie Lynn, who has been living with the disease for 2 decades, on the suggestion of mutual friend Lance Bass. Once the two touched base, they haven't stopped talking since, Applegate 52 shared. I wanted to give her tools and things that I've learned that have helped me, Jamie Lynn, 42, told the outlet. We would talk on the phone for 2 hours, and we'd be laughing and crying, and we were like, this is helping us. Let's record this. Let's do it, Applegate added. According to a description of the podcast, the show will feature the two stars getting vulnerable about the curveballs that life can throw. The series will also feature conversations with former co-stars like Martin Short and Edie Falco. The news has raised a lot of questions about Applegate's health and how she's doing right now. Here's everything the actress has shared about her MS diagnosis so far. She revealed her MS diagnosis in 2021. Applegate shared her diagnosis on X, formerly Twitter, with a post on August 10, 2021. Hi, friends. A few months ago, I was diagnosed with MS. It's been a strange journey, she wrote, but I have been so supported by people that I know who also have this condition. It's been a tough road, but as we all know, the road keeps going. At the time, she didn't say much more about the diagnosis, but later began to share more about her health journey. She had been experiencing physical symptoms that led her to see a doctor. In November 2022, Applegate told the New York Times that she'd started noticing symptoms while filming the third season of Dead to Me. She felt off balance while shooting a dancing scene and then noticed that her tennis game was off. Applegate says she missed early warning signs. Despite her symptoms, Applegate told the New York Times that she didn't connect her symptoms with anything more sinister at the time. I wish I had paid more attention, but who was I to know, she said. Applegate also told the outlet that she developed numbness and tingling in her extremities that got worse as time went on, so she eventually decided to see a doctor. Filming for Dead to Me was temporarily put on pause while she was trying to sort out her health issues. There was the sense of, well, let's get her some medicine so she can get better, she said. And there is no better. But it was good for me. I needed to process my loss of my life, my loss of that part of me, so I needed that time. Applegate also said that she's never going to accept her diagnosis, adding, "I'm pissed." She unveiled her Hollywood star while barefoot. Shortly after sharing this health update, Applegate received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame and went to the ceremony barefoot. She later went on X to explain why she didn't wear shoes. Barefoot. For some with MS, the feeling of shoes may hurt or make us feel off balance. So today I was me, barefoot, she wrote next to a photo of her feet on her star. Oh, by the way, I have a disease, she said, jokingly during her speech at the big event per People. Did you notice I'm not even wearing shoes? Anywho, you're supposed to laugh at that. Applegate got candid about her physical changes post-diagnosis. These days, the actor can't get around without the help of a cane. I put on 40 pounds. I can't walk without a cane. I want people to know that I'm very aware of all of that, she told New York Times. And all these physical struggles made it hard for her to finish filming Dead to Me because she couldn't work as long in heat and had a hard time walking downstairs and had to use a wheelchair to get to set, per the New York Times. Still, she persisted. Applegate gave another health update in 2023. In May of 2023, Applegate revealed to Vanity Fair that it's been hard for her to keep acting after her diagnosis. In fact, she shared that Dead to Me might be her last time on camera. With the disease of MS, it's never a good day, she said. Applegate added that it can be frightening to do simple things like take a shower. You can fall, you can slip, your legs can buckle, she said, especially because I have a glass shower. It's frightening to me to get in there. There are just certain things that people take for granted in their lives that I took for granted. Going down the stairs, carrying things, you can't do that anymore. Since her condition makes her more susceptible to infections, she also prefers to avoid crowds. She presented at the Emmys and talked about her diagnosis. Applegate was both a presenter and a nominee at the 2024 Emmy Awards on January 16, and she walked on stage with the help of a cane and fellow actor Anthony Anderson. She received a standing ovation from the audience. During her speech, Applegate referenced her diagnosis a few times, and despite getting emotional, lightened the room with a joke about her MS. "You're totally shaming me with disability by standing up," she joked. "It's fine." She tried to continue her speech by talking about her career, but as people kept clapping and cheering, she joked, "We don't have to applaud every time I do something." In March, Applegate shared that it was difficult to process the experience. "I actually kind of blacked out," she said during an interview with Robin Roberts on Good Morning America. "People said, 'Oh, you were so funny,' and I'm like, 'I don't even know what I said. I don't know what I was doing. I got so freaked out that I didn't even know what was happening anymore.'" But despite being nervous, Applegate said that she felt really beloved and it was really a beautiful thing. She's starting a podcast about her experience with MS. During the same interview, Applegate revealed that she's launching a new podcast called Messy with her friend and soprano star Jamie Lynn Sigler, who also has MS. According to the podcast description, the series will feature the stars as they self-reflect, learn, laugh, and grow through their own raw and oftentimes hilarious conversations with each other, friends, co-stars, and the people that kept them going through the messiness of life. And even though both hosts have MS, the podcast isn't only about their chronic disease, according to Sigler. "It's not about the specific experience we're having," she said. "It's us facing something hard. And it's about figuring out how to still push through." Parts of this article were edited due to time. Back in culture and news, everything to know about Beyoncé's upcoming album Cowboy Carter. She announced the new album in a surprise Super Bowl commercial, and we already have a release date. This article is by Chelsea Sanchez. At long last, Beyoncé is releasing the follow-up to Renaissance. The The superstar teased the upcoming album in a surprise Verizon commercial that aired during Super Bowl 58 on February 11. The ad shows Beyoncé attempting to break Verizon's 5G network with a number of attention-grabbing schemes, from opening a lemonade stand to putting a Bar-Bay spin on Barbie, before ultimately resorting to dropping the new music. Soon after the commercial aired, she released the first teaser for the new project on her Instagram. This is far from the first time Bay has dropped Easter eggs to promote new music. She teased latest album Renaissance in an interview for Harper's Bazaar September 2021 cover story. "I feel a renaissance emerging, and I want to be part of nurturing that escape in any way possible," she said at the time. "I've been in the studio for a year and a half. Sometimes it takes a year for me to personally search through thousands of sounds to find just the right kick or snare. One chorus can have up to 200 stacked harmonies. Still, there's nothing like the amount of love, passion, and healing that I feel in the recording studio. After 31 years, it feels just as exciting as it did when I was 9 years old. Yes, the music is coming." Ahead, we break down everything to know about the album she has billed as Act 2 of a trilogy that began with Renaissance. What is the new album called? In a March 12 post on the Instagram account for her company Parkwood Entertainment, Beyoncé announced that Act 2 is officially titled Cowboy Carter and shared promotional limited edition artwork along with the news. Beyoncé shared what experience ultimately inspired Cowboy Carter. Alongside unveiling the official album art for Cowboy Carter, Beyoncé opened up on Instagram about what inspired the Act 2 project. Specifically, she alluded to her 2016 CMA's performance with the Dixie Chicks, where fans speculated fellow country artists were not pleased to see her grace the award show stage. "I feel honored to be the first black woman with the number one single on the Hot Country Songs chart. That would not have happened without the outpouring of support from each and every one of you. My hope is that years from now, the mention of an artist's race as it relates to releasing genres of music will be irrelevant," she wrote. "This album has been over 5 years in the making. It was born out of an experience that I had years ago where I did not feel welcomed, and it was very clear that I wasn't. But because of that experience, I did a deeper dive into the history of country music and studied our rich musical archive. It feels good to see how music can unite so many people around the world, while also amplifying the voices of some of the people who have dedicated so much of their lives educating on our musical history." The star also promised a few surprises on the project and upcoming collaborations. Cowboy Carter as a whole, according to the artist, was a way to challenge her own artistry and how the world views her. "The criticism I faced when I first entered this genre forced me to propel past the limitations that were put on me. Act 2 is a result of challenging myself and taking my time to bend and blend genres together to create this body of work," she added. "I have a few surprises on the album and have collaborated with some brilliant artists who I deeply respect. I hope that you can hear my heart and soul and all the love and passion that I poured into every single detail and every sound." She continued, "I focused on this album as a continuation of Renaissance. I hope this music is an experience, creating another journey where you can close your eyes, start from the beginning, and never stop. This isn't a country album. This is a Beyoncé album. This is Act 2, Cowboy Carter, and I am proud to share it with y'all." What will be on the album? Though we don't know much about the specific contents of Cowboy Carter, it looks like it will pay homage to Bay's Texan roots, judging from the teaser she posted on Instagram after the Super Bowl ad aired on February 11. The clip shows her driving through a desert as banjo plays in the background, which led many fans to speculate she'd be shifting gears to release country music. She's waded into that genre before with Daddy Lessons from 2016's lemonade. What is the release date? Per the aforementioned Instagram posts, Cowboy Carter will drop March 29. What's the track list? While we don't have a full track list yet, Beyoncé did announce the name of the two lead singles, Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages. Both tracks are already available to stream. Are there any visuals? Yes, Beyoncé has already released two cover art images. One shows the singer wearing a metallic cut bra and a metallic chain garter and matching underwear, which she layered underneath a cropped leather jacket. She went big with her accessories, which included a black baseball cap and massive pair of sparkling earrings. The second image features a black and white portrait of Beyoncé, clad in a cowboy hat and a studded country western style shirt. This next article in Culture and News, Missen Harriman responds to allegations he photoshopped Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's family portrait. The photographer calls out the insidious and really dangerous journalism that accused him of photoshopping Harry and Meghan's pregnancy announcement photo from 2021. This article is by Emily Barak. Missen Harriman, a photographer and longtime friend of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, will not be pulled into the royal Photoshop drama. After an article alleged Harriman used Photoshop on the Duke and Duchess of Sussex pregnancy announcement in 2021, Harriman took to his social media to offer a firm reply. "Hey, I just got back to reality from the Oscars," he begins. Harriman was nominated this past weekend for his short film, The After. "And unfortunately, there's been an article on the Daily Mail saying that I have admitted to doctoring the pregnancy announcement portrait I took of Harry and Meghan. Apparently, I was switching out trees and meadows, and I admitted to this in an episode of a podcast called Private Passions. This is crazy. I was interviewed, I think, in 2022 by Michael Berkeley." Harriman then explains to the camera, "I'm going to play you the segment on Private Passions, and we were talking about the technology. I used to shoot people during lockdown, and many photographers were doing virtual shots in those days, and this is how we came onto the subject. Michael asked me a few leading questions in this interview. What I mean by leading questions is what some journalists do where they make a statement as fact, and they hope you respond or add something to it. I get that a lot in regards to Harry and Meghan, and I tend to swerve, ignore, try and get back on track, and say what I'm there to say rather than any sort of intrigue and gossip, and that's exactly what happened." He then turns on audio from the 2022 BBC Radio 3 show. In that interview, Harriman says, "My most well-known virtual shoot is the portrait I took of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle announcing their pregnancy. It's a very joyous image. The technology allows you to take over a phone or an iPad and then hear my voice, and I can still press the shutter and compose with ease. It's extraordinary what you can do with technology." Berkeley then asks Harriman, "They weren't actually under a willow tree. They were lying outside in a meadow, Harry and Meghan, when you took a photo of them." Harriman replies, "They were lost in their life at home, in their garden, comfortable, celebrating new joy, new life. The fortitude of hoping for light in life after such a loss that they went through with a miscarriage. And so it really was a particularly joyous image to celebrate life itself." He turns off the audio of the interview, and Harriman then says, "So how that exchange could amount to me admitting to doctoring an image is insidious and really dangerous journalism. Any mention of meadows and willow trees came out of the person doing the interview, not my mouth. I did my best to ignore it and focus on what I wanted to talk about. So to see an article saying, as fact, that I did what I did not do is extraordinary to me. And then to try and merge it with this current news cycle of what's happening, it's tragic to see." He ends his message, "It was a virtual shoot that I shot on an iPad, and an 8-megapixel iPad. And the only thing that was changed is the black and white color grade. That's in it in the Daily Mail, and the journalist that wrote this has to be better than this dangerous and unacceptable behavior." While Harriman never mentioned Kate Middleton by name in his video, the news story that accused him of photoshopping the Sussexes is clearly linked to the fallout of the Princess of Wales admitting to editing a family photo that was released by Kensington Palace this past weekend. While Kate issued a personal apology, it has not done much to quiet conspiracy theories online and has turned into a PR disaster for the palace. Over in books, this book is hopefully to help with sleep. Rest is Resistance by Tricia Hersey, H-E-R-S-E-Y. In this aptly titled manifesto, the founder of the Nap Ministry wakes us up to the power of sleep, not just as a self-care practice, but as a social justice imperative. Hersey's awareness of the political power of sleep came out of a personal problem. She was exhausted. While in a brutally busy graduate program with financial issues, family illness, and the threat of racial violence always swirling around, I started to experiment with rest, she writes. That experiment soon grew into an organization. Founded in 2016, the Nap Ministry uses social media, workshops, performance art, and collective napping experiences, essentially guided grown-up sleepovers in public parks, private galleries, yoga studios, and other sacred nap spaces to spread its gospel of good sleep. Lifting its title from the ministry's tagline, Rest is Resistance, offers practical tips and political motivation for slowing down and resting up. In these pages, as in sleep, the boundaries between the past and the present have no bearing. Hersey seamlessly weaves her own experience of rest and of racism together with those of her ancestors. Her grandmother, who rested her eyes for 30 minutes a day after fleeing racial violence in the Jim Crow South. Her great-grandmother, who stayed up at night with her pistol looking out for signs of the Klan and draws a clean line between histories of racial and economic injustice in our contemporary grind culture that emphasizes productivity over all else. Rest can come in many forms, from deleting an app a week to closing your eyes for 10 minutes, and so too can liberation. This book is at once a battle cry and a lullaby, and it's $19 at Amazon. Again, it is called Rest is Resistance by Tricia Hersey. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.